Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 39 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Duncan Shields of Chronologically Speaking. Welcome back to the show, Duncan.
Thank you for having me back. I'm loving these minutes.
I'm glad you are. Just, keep that knapsack tightly closed so that no one can tell what you got in there.
Right.
So minute 39 begins with Theo typing away at the computer and ends with John kicking off Tony's shoes from his foot. So yesterday we ended the minute with McLean landing on Tony as they both were tumbling down the stairs, and we heard a little bit of a gasp or a grunt or some sort of sound from Tony. That was the last we'll hear of Tony in this movie.
Yes.
Even though he still has some integral, things to do. That's going to come up next week. Yeah. That's right. Next week he's iconicized, but people have to wait until next week to find out what that is if you don't know yet. And then we actually got a nice break from the scene because this minute begins a completely different scene. So we're back to seeing Theo. Theo is the computer expert that they brought, I'm still trying to figure out what his job really is here, because he's just really good at, constantly, clicking the keyboard. That's what he does. he's a fast typist.
He's also to be a bit of a sociopathic polymath. Like he goes from cracking the lock and hacking, quote unquote, hacking the lock into legitimately setting up and using an industrial drill.
Yeah.
So I'm like, this guy's got a bottomless amount of training and interests.
Yeah, for sure. So, we see on the screen, it says, there's a picture of an Oriental man. Okay. We don't know his name, but we get to see on the screen a little bit of his profile. It says, the military record assigned aircraft carrier Akagi, July 1940. Okay, then it says campaigns and battles, Pearl Harbor, Rabaul, Darwin, Java, Ceylon. Then it says underneath something like military wounded. You can't really see exactly what it says. I like the fact that they have a keyboard that a few of the letters are lit up on top, very 80s technology that they're using here by showing
very
this
much
stuff.
So, yeah.
Very retro for that time. And then it shows on the screen Akagi, and it says English translation, Red Castle. Okay. So first of all, I actually looked up, does Akagi really mean Red Castle? And it turns out that it actually has three different meanings. It's not just Red Castle.
Okay.
It could mean all Red right. Castle, it could mean Red Tree, or it could mean Red Future.
Red Future?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Red Future. Oh, I love it.
And it's a there were two Japanese ships named Akagi. There was a gunboat named Akagi in the Sino-Japanese War. And there was the aircraft carrier Akagi, which served during World War II. There is also a mountain in the Kanto region of Japan called Mount Akagi. Okay, so I don't really know. It's also a typical Japanese surname. I don't know how prevalent it really is, but it is something that's used often.
Where did you say it was? Where did you say the mountain was?
The mountain is in the Kanto region, Kanto, and the O has a line above it. So maybe I'm mispronouncing it.
No, I got it. I got it down as being in the Gunma Prefecture.
No, that's the village
on the Honshu.
That's the village. There is a village named Akagi that's in the Gunma Prefecture.
I see. I got that.
There is also a former town in the Shiman Prefecture that was known as Akagi. I figured I wasn't going to go into everything. There's a train service called the Akagi, in Japan.
Yeah,
there's
sure.
also a song mountain, performed by Maximum the Hormone called Akagi. Don't really know much about it. So it was an aircraft carrier that was part of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it was sunk during the Midway campaign, about a year and a half later.
So okay. It looks like the list of battles here is somewhat accurate then.
Yes, it is. I actually have some information about where the Akagi served during World War II. So awesome. Here, it says Akagi's aircraft served in the Second Sino-Japanese War in the late 30s. Upon the formation of the 1st Air Fleet in early 1941, it became the flagship and remained so for the duration of her service. With other fleet carriers, she took part in the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 and the invasion of Rabaul in the Southwest Pacific in January 1942. The following month, her aircraft bombed Darwin, Australia, and assisted in the conquest of the Dutch East Indies. In March and April 1942, Akagi's aircraft helped sink a British heavy cruiser and an Australian destroyer in the Indian Ocean raid. Okay, then it mentions that it participated in the Battle of Midway in June 1942. And after bombarding American forces on the atoll, Akagi and other carriers were attacked by aircraft from Midway and the carriers Enterprise, Hornet, and Yorktown. Dive bombers from Enterprise severely damaged Akagi. When it became obvious she could not be saved, she was scuttled by Japanese destroyers to prevent her from falling into enemy hands. The loss of Akagi and three other Japanese carriers at Midway was a crucial strategic defeat for Japan and contributed significantly to the Allies' ultimate victory in the Pacific. Her wreck was located in October 2019 by the research vessel Petrel. So yeah, that's where he served. Nice. Whoever this guy, maybe Akagi is his name. I don't know.
I think it is. It might not be. It's like you said, it's a common surname. I'm glad to hear you say that he is a mystery to you, because I thought, okay, I'm getting these minutes. I haven't seen Die Hard in a long time. I guess he's somebody that was somewhere else in the movie, but I'm glad to hear you say that he's like some guy.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that you found out who he was.
No.
Well, my assumption is that he's one of the higher, he's even higher up than Takagi, because Takagi, Takagi said a few weeks ago, you know, my code's not going to help you because there are seven different codes that you need. And, you know, in Tokyo, they're going to change it every day.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty ironic that if they change it every day, you know, Akagi Red Castle is actually one of, you know, is still one of the, you know, one of the passcodes, but whatever. Yeah. A minor discrepancy. And then after he puts in, you know, Red Castle, so it says access code accepted, lock number one disabled. Do you wish to proceed? And Theo, as always, you know, is right on the ball and says, "You bet your ass, I wish to proceed." You know, he's talking to nobody, he's talking to the computer. So it says a lot about who. You know, what type of computer geek he is.
I think Theo enjoys his own company.
Yes, that's true. Well, you didn't bring me along for my charming personality, did you? You know, he did say that. You know,
yeah, I like Theo a lot because I think it's hard to find a better example of somebody who's like, I don't know, gleefully sociopathic. You know, like he's, you know, like it's at a lot of points in these films, like, the sort of cheery sidekick or the computer nerd has a moment of being the weak one, you know, yes. Where like the real strong guys kill some people and the computer nerd goes, "Oh geez, are we the bad guys here? That was kind of harsh," or something like that, where they expose that they're actually gentle creatures. They just happen to be really down with binary. But, you know, you show them anything resembling a gun and they're like, "Eek," you know. And but this is like one of the only characters that I can remember where he's part of the team and he is, you know, the hacker or whatever. But he's got glasses, but he's not nerdy. You know, right. He's not like the nerdy nerdster who's also kind of a nerd. You know, he's not like the, you know, like this condescending, you know, brittle, you know, reference laden, Hawaiian shirt wearing, Cheetos eating nerd character. He's strong, he's ripped, he's really good looking, and he happens to be a hacker, and he's happily sociopathic. Like, you know, when he sees the guys get torched and says, like, and the quarterback is toast, he's like, he's Deadpool, but he's on like the wrong side. He's on the bad guy's team. So I really like it because, you know, he's arguably the smartest one on the team besides Hans Gruber, and he's cheerfully unaffected by people dying right in front of them and even being responsible for their deaths. So I just,
and always using sports and always using sports euphemisms.
Yeah. And, you know, he's got that, you know, and it's weird to see, like I guess an actor of color being in that role. Whenever I've seen, like, the, you know, the hacker in a movie, it's always usually like a skinny white nerd kid, you know, or at least it was in the 80s. In the 80s, right. That was the, you wanted your Anthony Michael Hall stereotype behind the keyboard, you know, or your Matthew Broderick or someone like that. That those were your hackers.
But those were the good guys. That's the thing.
But those were the good guys. Yeah.
This is a bad guy. So
there you go. That I guess that is worthy to know. Yeah, so he's on the team of the bad guys. So, right. But he's a fascinating character to me, and I know
for sure
we don't get to. I'm sure you've talked more about him in all the other minutes, but I just wanted to say I love his character.
Yeah, he's definitely great. And then he puts on some goggles. And then a machine begins to whirl and drill and stuff like that. Now, I'm trying to figure out what is going on here. He has the code. Why does he need to drill?
Well, there's four or five layers, right? So he's gotten
through layer seven layers. One. There's seven layers.
Seven layers. Yeah, there's seven layers. So he's gotten through one layer, and now he's going through to another
layer.
But
why does he have to drill through them if he has the code? I mean, if you have a code, you put in the code, and then it opens it up.
Well, the code's like for the alarm, but not necessarily for the lock. That's what I was.
Ah, so he's like drilling through. He's drilling through the lock. You're saying?
Yeah, the lock mechanism of the next level. That's fair. So I figured it was like it was like a technological level. You know, like the stereotypical laser grid, you know, or whatever. But then there's like an actual lock that if you don't know the combination, you can drill out a couple of parts. And that's just as good. And so I figured that's the next stage that he's on to.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. And then the scene changes and we get to see McClane opening up a knapsack and starts pulling things out from the knapsack. You know, he pulls out two full clips of 9mm bullets, which could have been very useful to Tony beforehand, before he spent all the ones that he had. Okay, he pulls out a walkie-talkie, pulls out a Zippo lighter, that he opens and he flips it on, you know, and, you know, turns on the Zippo lighter and he like looks around to make sure like nobody's watching him. It's like really funny. There's a few times in the scene where he takes things out of the knapsack and he looks around that, okay, I don't want to get caught, you know, because like he takes the Zippo and puts it in his pocket. You know, that who's looking at him, this whole thing. So.
Well, and it's oddly like, dude, you just murdered a guy.
Yeah, you know, and broke the door.
And I hope no one sees me steal this Zippo. I'm like, okay, you really gotta, you're kind of picking and choosing your morality moves here. Yeah. You know,
exactly.
He's a little part of that 80s good guy. Like, he can kill the bad guys remorselessly because they're bad guys. And it's like, well, you're actually a little scary here. You're actually, the way you're just sort of gleefully taking out the bad guys is like, well, are you on the side of good? You know, like, of course he is because it's an action movie, but
right.
The way he patted the dead body, the way he pats Tony's dead body, like, good boy, good boy. That really struck me as a psychotic thing to do.
You know? Well, and then right after he finishes with the knapsack, he begins to pat the body again because he's, you know, packing it down. And I never noticed this before, but the first thing that he does is look at the tags on his sweatshirt.
Yeah, what the heck? What's that about? I'm like, why do you check the clothing label? I know in a lot of movies, sometimes when a spy gets caught, they mention that the spy has ripped the labels out of all of his clothing, rendering it impossible to identify where he bought the clothes.
But who cares? So you bought them in Kmart. You bought them in,
Yeah, like, is that ever going to be a lead? Like, if it's like a bespoke tailor in Britain, then okay. But like...
Yeah, I'm not really sure why he's looking at the tags on the clothing. And then he pats him down. He's looking for something, for anything. Okay?
Yeah.
And then somehow he finds a wallet. Now, Tony is wearing a sweatsuit.
Yeah, okay, yeah, you notice this too. Yeah, yeah.
Where is he hiding his wallet?
He doesn't get it out of a pocket. He reaches into Tony's pants and yes. pulls out a wallet. So it's like yeah. the wallet was just loose in his pants, and they just
his underwear, quickly... the elastic on his underwear was keeping that wallet in place.
Tucked into his underwear.
I'm not going to go back and look, but I wonder if you can notice, like, you know, in previous scenes when he's walking around, if there's like a bulge on the side of his, you know, on the side of his pants.
A rectangular junk bulge of some kind, or just a rectangular. That's right. Bulge.
Because like it's not as if, you know, like where do you keep your wallet? Okay,
in my back pocket.
Okay, so I keep my wallet in my front pocket.
I know, well, yeah, well, that's advisable. I know when I travel, I keep it in my front pocket. I know that, like in my swimsuit, sometimes they'll have a little pocket on the inside for like keys, I guess, or whatever. And so maybe he's got a little pocket on the inside of his sweatpants, but I've never encountered that in real life. So,
but even if he has a little pocket, how is he going to fit his wallet in there?
It's not
a little pocket, you know?
No.
So it's a magic wallet.
It's a magic wallet.
I don't know. I don't get it. Something.
The actor does a great job of keeping his eyes and, you know, being dead here, because Bruce Willis is literally tickling his armpits.
Yeah.
You know, going through him, and he has to just not move at all.
Yeah.
And he does very well.
Right. I mean, I quickly just looked through the past few minutes from this week, and there's no point where you can see that he has some sort of bulge on the side of his of where this wallet apparently is hiding. But again, yesterday we were talking about Harry Potter, so there you go. So he's got, you know, some sort of magic spell that allows him to place the wallet somewhere in his magic pants. Who knows? And so at this point, McClane takes the wallet and opens it up, and we can see what looks like a driver's license. And it actually, you can actually read what it says. It says Richard G. Aronson, 15306 Riverside Drive, Sherman Oaks, California, 91423. And it expires on the birthday 1990. But it doesn't show anywhere the birthday. Like, how does, you know, you get pulled over. All right. If this is a real license, right? A driver's license. It's supposed to be a fake license, right? So, but it's based on something that's real. So if you get pulled over, how does the cop know, you know, okay, it expires in 1990. Right now it is 1990. What day is your birthday? Has it expired? Has it not? You know, it's, I think this is a detail that they somehow missed. That's what I think. What do you think about that?
I think that they had it as a placeholder and that they didn't correct it in time for the film.
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm when I did a search for driver's license from nowadays, you know, it doesn't really. Oh, okay. Here, I can actually, I found one from the 1970s. That's actually funny. It's Alfred Hitchcock's driver's license from 1977.
Wild.
And, yeah, Alfred Joseph Hitchcock. Joseph. Right, and it has more information on there than they do in this movie.
Yeah.
Because it also has. You know, it says male, brown hair, brown eyes, height, weight, and then it also has birthday. You know, he was born on August 13th, 1899, right? Not 1999, 1899. So, you know, but on this fake ID, which later on, you know, John is chastised for not being able to notice, or for being able to know, for being able to claim that he can find he can spot a phony ID. You know, apparently this ID is missing some very interesting integral
crucial stuff,
you know, aspects to it. Yeah. And it has like a few little pictures on there also, like different types of cars.
Yeah.
On the fake one. So
the other thing,
they didn't get that
one. The other thing is,
and the signature also, it looks to me that the name Aronson is misspelled in the signature.
Great fake ID, Tony. Great fake ID. But there's also...
He could be a bartender for all you...
There's nothing in the wallet besides the ID, which is also kind of strange.
Nothing.
It's just bereft of anything besides that ID. So this whole prop is kind of, I don't know, I don't know if it's a bit of a fail or if it's supposed to just show that this is how thin the illusion is with this whole crew, is that they're
but again, they're not expecting anyone to pay attention to these things.
Their
like
disguises,
we are.
You know, their disguises won't stand up to a deep dive, but they're good enough for a. Yeah, here's my ID. A flick in a glance.
There you go. Who knows? And then we, the shot changes, and we see the bare feet of Tony, and then the camera moves to the right, and we see the bare feet of McLean, who is unsuccessfully trying to get his foot in this shoe.
Yes.
And then he makes a classic line. He says, 9 million terrorists in the world, and I got to kill one with feet smaller than my sister. And his sister is never mentioned in any of the other movies. So she's part of the canon that John McLean has a sister somewhere at some point, but not here. Nice.
I don't for a second believe that this giant German murder machine has feet smaller than McLean's sister. Not for a second. and we see his feet, and then it tracks over to McLean, and they appear to me to be the same size or bigger than McLean's. You know, I mean, they're right there. And I'm like, okay, this guy's 2 feet taller than Bruce Willis, and he's got little tiny feet. I doubt it. It's fun. It's fun, and it contributes to the plot, and it's a good line. So I'm not pointing it out as a flaw. I'm just like, no.
Yeah.
It was like it happened in it was in Tron. Jeff Bridges' character was supposed to be like 60. Tron's supposed to be this old hulking gladiator, and then the computer expert that gets pulled in is supposed to be this little skinny nerd. And so you're supposed to have this giant old hulking gladiator and a little skinny nerd, and they team up inside the grid. But then they got Jeff Bridges and Bruce Boxleitner, who are both literally 6'2 and weigh almost the exact same. And so it's like, from the back, you can't tell these guys apart. So it's kind of like this with the feet. I'm like, these feet look like they do not look smaller than McLean's.
Right. Sure. All right, so the script has a few little minor discrepancies once again, but I love the description here. It says, for a moment, McLean just looks at the dead man. Then slowly, methodically, he begins to search him. He turns all of his pockets inside out, looks at his clothing labels, stares long and hard at a California driver's license with Tony's picture on it. He expertly examines the machine gun when a hissing sound coming from somewhere attracts his attention. He rises, moves cautiously to the source. It's Tony's CB, which has fallen from the dead man's waist during the struggle. McLean stares at it, formulating a plan.
Okay.
And then it says, we pan from Tony's now shoeless feet to McLean, who sits on the floor next to the body, hurriedly lacing up the dead terrorist boots on his own feet. He ties the last lace and tries to take a couple of steps. He winces in pain, goes off balance. Quickly, he starts taking the boots off. A million terrorists in the world, and I killed the one with feet smaller than my sister. He yanks off the boots and tosses them. So, again, a few minor things. I like the fact that he finds the CB and other things in the bag, as opposed to just having it fall on the floor like it does in Die Hard 2. Yeah. That's where, you know, in that one, that's where he does find the CB on the floor like that. But, and, you know, the difference between a million and 9 million terrorists, you know, I wonder if that was just an ad lib on, you know, Bruce Willis's part at that
time. Yeah. Yeah. It Who rolls knows? Off the tongue a little quicker. It could be that vocal rhythm thing we were talking about earlier for sure.
Yeah.
And I like that. Yeah, well, checking the clothing labels is in the script. So
yeah.
What the heck?
But it also says he checks all his pockets, but he doesn't have any pockets. So
I wonder if that was on the day. They're like, oh my gosh, guys, he has no pockets.
Oh my god, he showed up wearing sweatpants.
The audience won't notice. Just put the wallet loose inside his pants, and no one will notice.
Yes, the magic wallet.
Hammer space. It's like behind the back of the cartoon characters. You can just pull out a hammer. You can pull out a, you know.
There you go.
So that's what it is.
That's right. That works. All right. So every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where either myself or my guest will give a little holiday story about something, an adventure, a misadventure, or something that happened to us along the way during the journey of life, but around the holidays. So, Duncan, do you have another story for
sort
us?
Sort of just one of the times I always enjoyed the holidays was when my mom's mom was still alive, and she had this giant house in the interior of BC here in Canada called the Okanagan. It was like it's like Kelowna. It's a lot of orchards, a lot of wine, a lot of vineyards. It's a quasi desert in the summer in parts. It's a very hot summer there, and it's a beautiful, beautiful region. And my grandma had this huge dining room table and a good number of bedrooms in her house. So a bunch of the family lived close, but a few of us had to drive a good ways to show up. And every Easter we did that, every Christmas, usually sometime in the summer, as having this big old family get together on a sizable plot of land with all the cousin and uncles and grandparents and all that on my mom's side, playing hide and seek. And they're really special memories of this big long table with everybody eating together. And after she passed, the house was sold, and nobody really has the space or inclination to host the whole family like that on a regular basis again. So it kind of it died with her. And it was an old school family gathering, and that doesn't really happen much anymore. But those are really, really special memories to me.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. Thank you very much for that story. Why don't you once again tell people where they can find you?
TorontoLogicallySpeaking.com. The Time Bandits, I think it's the Time Bandits. I'm scared that I've been telling everybody the wrong place to go. You can go to the Time Bandits Minute on Twitter. That's a good place to go for it as well.
All right, great. All right. When while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe on any podcast you might be listening to this show on. And finding me is quite simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, or you can go to my website, moviearoundminute.com. So, Duncan, you feel like coming back again tomorrow to finish off this week?
Heck yes.
All right. Excellent. So we will see you tomorrow, and we hope everyone comes back. But until then, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.